Nevada passed a bill in the assembly yesterday that eases some of the restrictions on abortion. This is, as you probably know, the opposite direction of some recent actions in Alabama, Georgia, and a number of other states. On Insight, Nevada's legislature is also the first in the country to have women in the majority. I'll talk about the state's politics with Reno Gazette Journal reporter James DeHaven. Teachers from across California are gathering just about now at the state capitol. They're going to march, lobby, and rally for more and different school funding. Cap Radio reporter Scott Rodd will talk with me about some of the changes teachers are hoping for. And we made a wish that's coming true today. The genie and Aladdin from the touring Broadway musical are expected to appear in our studio, and we'll meet them for a bit of fun. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Nevada is the only state in the country where women hold the majority of seats in the state legislature. And yesterday, lawmakers in the assembly there passed a bill that eases some requirements in Nevada's abortion laws. Now, this goes in the opposite direction of the restrictive legislation that's been signed into law in Alabama last week and moving through the lawmakers' pipeline in many other states. These agendas would limit abortion rights. But the Nevada bill now goes back to the Senate, and then it'll go on to the governor. There is a lot to dive into in Nevada politics. And joining us by phone is James DeHaven. He is the political reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal. Hi, James. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So abortion laws are in the national spotlight right now. Can you say more about this legislation that the Assembly passed yesterday and a version of it that the Senate passed earlier?
Yeah, so Senate Bill 179 decriminalizes abortions in Nevada. The state has had a law on the books for many years that can technically send doctors to jail for performing an abortion after 24 weeks. No one's ever been prosecuted under it, but it was on the books, and so they wanted to clean that up. SB 179 also strikes a requirement that requires doctors to explain the physical and emotional implications of getting an abortion, and it allows them to just describe the nature and consequence of the procedure as opposed to going into other specifics about it. And they no longer have to record the age of the patient seeking an abortion. So those are the major provisions, and it's expected to get to Governor Sisolak's desk here pretty shortly.
Talk about the fact that the governor has made clear where he stands on this issue. He's a new governor. He is a Democrat. So I think most people can guess what might happen, but what's being said there about what the governor might do?
Well, Sisolak hasn't explicitly said that he's going to sign it, but I think it's fair to say that he's expected to sign it. You know, he's a pro-choice Catholic, but a Democrat, and he's never said that he is even hedging on this bill or anything remotely like it. I think it's fair to say it's going to get done in the coming days.
The assembly vote, I think, James, went pretty much along party lines. And we can reflect on the Senate bill as well. But that's the key to the story, too, is where party lines are and the number of votes on each side. I think the assembly vote was 27-13. So talk about not only this piece of legislation, but in general, what's happening there with the changing face and gender in particular.
Well, Democrats run the show, and now women run the show, frankly. So the bills like the abortion decriminalization bill, a lot of pharmaceutical, sort of crackdown legislation that's moving ahead of the legislature. These are things that maybe would have been more contentious in past sessions, but now really, frankly, they're flying through. And so that's been a key difference that you've seen, under the female majority, maybe as distinct from past sessions.
It's probably worth talking a bit about the difference between Nevada and California in terms of lawmakers' jobs and when they meet. We're saying they are in session now, but will you note the difference?
Well, yeah. I mean, in Nevada, the legislature only meets every other year for 4 months. So it's 120 days of madness, pretty much. There's a lot of procrastinating, just as there is with anyone else doing their job, I guess. But it seems especially acute when you're only there for, again, such a short period of time, and you have so much to do. And, you know, legally under the Constitution, they have to balance the budget. So that takes up a lot of headspace and a lot of bandwidth in the building. And then getting other types of social policies out sometimes can take a back seat, although, you know, our economy is doing fairly well. The budget should be coming together in the next few days. And, you know, if not, I guess we'll have to go into a special session. But I would say that's the primary difference between Nevada and California from a legislative point of view. There's always folks in Sacramento getting stuff done. In Nevada, Carson City is just one big zoo for, you know, every other year.
Some people might differ with you on how much gets done in California or when it's getting done.
That's true.
The one place now that Nevada stands alone is that women hold 50.8% of the state's legislative seats. There are 23 in the Assembly, 9 in the Senate. I guess no state has ever surpassed the 50% mark with a female majority. There's an article that you and the staff worked on titled Meet the 12 Women Who Turned the Nevada Legislature into the First Ever Female Majority. Give me some of the basics about this group of 12.
Yeah, so 9 of the new female legislators, and that's the group that we were referring to when we said 12, is the ones who are brand new, freshmen this session. 9 of them were voted in. 3 of them were appointed. If I remember correctly, all but 2 of them were Democrats. So this is, by and large, a pretty young group, but also very diverse. There's school teachers in there. There's, you know, lawyers. There's actually 2 or 3 lawyers, come to think of it. There's a longtime culinary union rep. So they bring a lot of, you know, a whole array of experiences, I guess. And I think that's really helped add flavor to this session, which otherwise has been bogged down for various reasons. But yeah, this new bunch, this freshman batch, has been really interesting to watch them assert themselves. They have not been timid at all. They don't, you know, sit there during meetings and quietly learn. They get themselves into, you know, important spots on committees, and they speak their mind on the floor. And they've been, again, just very assertive. So that's been refreshing to see.
You're right. All Democrats except Alexis Hansen from Sparks, who's a Republican, and Melissa Hardy from Henderson, who's a Republican. How many of the 12 have held an office before, James?
None of them. I don't think.
You're right. One has held an elected office before.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I think that contributes to sort of the new flavor that they're bringing is they just haven't done this before. They haven't, you know, paid their dues on, you know, county commissions or on the city council. And that can sometimes sap the ingenuity out of politicians, if you will. If you don't know what you're supposed to be doing, you have a tendency to do things differently. And that is, I think, has been a nice shift this session.
In that same Reno Gazette Journal article, the interviews with each of the different new lawmakers illuminated a couple common themes in what they think about this new majority. Many said things like, there will be a huge impact on the state. It reflects a new generation of voters, new activists, new leaders, a new opportunity to be heard and taken seriously, fresh ideas, a unique voice, and then that it will open up eyes in other states as well. So this is from within the lawmakers. What about the reaction and perception outside to this brand new legislature?
I think the reaction and perception from outside, especially from, you know, national media outlets or whatever who come in and are looking at this, is that we're going to, you know, that this female majority is going to be pushing a lot of, you know, stuff, a lot of female-focused initiatives. That hasn't so much been the case. I mean, the abortion decriminalization bill is a big deal, and they've been heavily focused on that. They've introduced sexual or human trafficking legislation. They've done things on domestic violence. They've introduced a number of measures like that. But broadly, they've been focused on, you know, hardcore policy issues, education being the main one, healthcare, drier, not identity politics focused stuff that, you know, is a tougher pill to swallow legislatively. You know, it's easy to go out there and score points on a tampon tax bill or something that's going to pass very quickly. It's harder to push through stuff that really makes a change in the state for all the residents. So they've been focused on that. And more than one of them has told me that the way they see the female majority is, okay, well, that's one state down. We have, you know, 49 more to go or whatever. They see themselves as just sort of the bellwether for this. And it's going to become a trend nationwide.
I am talking with James DeHaven, political reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal. Even the Washington Post took notice and published an article. We should add a link to it on our webpage. The title is Where Women Call the Shots. And it's pointed out in there, James, that even though the election of President Trump in 2016 mobilized Democratic women in particular across the country, already in Nevada, There was a high number of lawmakers in the legislature. So it's not like this was a sudden and dramatic shift. It is over the majority. But what had the showing been in terms of women elected to office?
Oh, gosh. I mean, yeah, we have been trending toward a female majority for a couple sessions. And they've been a loud voice in Carson City for some time now. I think what changed this time around in 2018 to push it over the top into becoming an actual majority was there was a nonprofit candidate recruiting group out of Vegas, and their name escapes me at the moment, but they did a lot of work recruiting almost every single one of the new female lawmakers that have come in, apart from the ones who were appointed. They found these candidates, they linked them up with the Democratic Party, they helped get them funded, and it's, you know, also, they came in at the right time, right? So there was the broader national trend of the Year of the Woman that was played up a lot. It was a blue wave election, so that favored a lot of these female candidates who, again, were almost uniformly Democrats. So some of it was just striking while the iron was hot, so to speak.
They range in age from 23 to 67. Are there one or two voices or personalities that have become particularly vocal? I know one of the new senators has been getting more attention because she really efforted this changing abortion bill. But what else in terms of that question?
Dallas Harris, who is one of the appointees, she was a lawyer for the State Public Utilities Commission, is actually still a lawyer for them. She's very feisty. I think even she would self-describe that way. And she's been really good on marijuana issues. She's been very assertive on other things that are not so easy to understand when you're coming in from the outside as someone who doesn't have a lot of previous policy experience. So I think she's been a real standout. Sarah Peters from up here in Reno stands out not just because of her purple hair, but because of a bill she carried to make neon the state element, which is kind of a fun, you know, agreeable bill. But it also...
Wait,
is,
say that
you know,
again.
You know,
to make neon the state element?
Yeah, neon the state element, yes.
<That's>...
so she got a lot of press for that. But she's also very... she's an environmental engineer by trade. So she's very good on wonkish resource bills that, you know, again, most of us, if we had to try and read them, we would fall asleep immediately. But she has been very attuned to that type of stuff. And I think both of them have been really standouts as far as the freshman class is concerned.
So a quote from Sarah Peters in your article is, "We have different perspectives and perceptions and experiences that we bring into the way we legislate. We talk about equity. We talk about unintended consequences. And those are conversations women have in a different way than men." And a quote from Dallas Harris, you said the Democrat from Las Vegas, is, "If I have anything to say about it, the first female majority is going to have a huge impact on the state of Nevada in a positive way. By raising the level of discourse, collaborating, and getting things done, as women are known to do." part of being able to pass legislation is collaborating, getting along, reaching across the aisle and working together. So how is that happening in this new legislature?
Well, yeah, to that point, I can't really overemphasize the fact that you could almost fit the Republican caucus, you know, in a car together, right? So you don't hardly need, if you're Dallas Harris or Sarah Peters, to negotiate with them. But that said, they have worked hard to be as bipartisan as possible and to hear a lot of Republican bills. And even the Republican legislative leaders have, at least occasionally, applauded them for, you know, giving them a fair shake on stuff. Even the Republicans don't have the votes to stand in the way of, frankly, anything the Democrats want to do. I think that it's noteworthy that the Democrats have saw fit to include them in the process.
So the legislature had two resignations, I believe, and an unexpected death, and those have been hurdles for everyone to deal with. Has that changed the pace of business in some ways?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you have stuff like that happen, it's really a domino effect because you have to fill those seats once they're vacated, right? The county commissioners have to appoint someone to step in there. You have to shuffle around chairs on the committees. And in the case of Kelvin Atkins' resignation, you have to replace him with the new Senate Majority Leader, which is a big job. And Nicole Cannizzaro has stepped up and I think been a very effective leader in that role. But, I mean, all the bills that these guys who resigned, and Tyrone Thompson's case, he died, unfortunately, all of their bills had to be shifted to a new sponsor. They had to be picked up by someone else or abandoned. It just becomes a logistics nightmare. So it's more than just a few days of observances or a distraction. It's really it can change the whole tenor of the session, and I think it has.
All right, James, I'm looking at one more piece of legislation that we'll note, and thank you for your time today. Would you explain a bit about the gun show loophole and how the group of female legislators made a difference in this?
Well, I mean, the background checks bill was, it was again, one of those cases where it was always going to pass, right? But I think the female legislature in particular really interacted closely with the Moms Demand Action group and one of the other gun control advocacy groups whose name escapes me. But, you know, these were moms who were showing up in their red shirts, and they were very active and very vocal about this stuff. And they sort of naturally gravitated, in my opinion, toward the female lawmakers and really struck up a dialogue with them that helped advance the bill in ways that maybe it might not have advanced as quickly. I think that's probably the primary role that they played in that. The legislation was, basically copy and paste from Every Down for Gun Safety, the Michael Bloomberg supported group. But as far as getting it through and getting it through in a way that advocates wanted to see it done, and on the anniversary of the Parkland shooting, that was all, you can chalk a lot of that up to female lawmakers and Democratic lawmakers in Carson City in general.
And has that been signed into law now, SB 143?
Yeah, that was signed on the day. So
on that day. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, James. Well, I'm glad to talk with you. Let's stay in touch as this season and then on into the presidential campaign unfolds. And I'm glad to have you with us on Insight.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
That is political reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal, James DeHaven. We'll post a link to some of his articles and the article from the Washington Post. And this is Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight Live on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Hundreds of teachers from across California are coming to Sacramento, in fact, gathering right now, because today is a day of meeting, marching, lobbying, and rallying. And the purpose is to address school funding issues. You might have heard yesterday's show. I talked with KQED correspondent Lily Jamali about school strikes across the state and about contract issues. Joining me in the studio now is CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Beth. Good morning.
So let's talk first about what's happening today. Then we'll go into a little bit of background.
Sure. So it's, as you said, a full day of activities that they have planned. People are already starting to gather at the Capitol right now. And in the morning, the plan is to do a bit of lobbying, raising on the radar of some legislators the legislative priorities of the California Teachers Association. And they have a range of bills that they're looking to highlight on lawmakers' radar. Anything from funding to also charter schools. So that'll take place in the morning. Then at 1:30, there's going to be a march at the Capitol. They'll be marching through downtown. This is going to be a group of educators, parents, community members. And following that, around 5 o'clock, there's going to be a rally. And then I believe also a concert as well that's going to take place with the rally.
All of this was planned in conjunction with what was going to be a one-day strike in the Sacramento City Unified School District today. The strike has been canceled because negotiations were progressing, but the day of action is still happening. So somewhere in there, the goals obviously seem bigger than the district and more important.
Yes. So as you mentioned, the strike in Sacramento is not happening, but a lot of the underlying issues and concerns that other districts around the state that they're feeling, it's very much on the minds of people who are coming to the Capitol today. So I don't think it's necessarily taken out any of the urgency that people are feeling at the Capitol today. And so, again, a big piece of it is funding. Sacramento is certainly not the only district that's feeling the funding crunch. There are other districts such as Oakland, Los Angeles, up and down the state that are also saying, hey, we have concerns about our funding as well, feeling the effects of Prop 13 and feeling the effects of other things that are sort of eating away at local funding for schools. So even though the strike isn't happening, there's still going to be a lot of passion today at the Capitol.
Yeah, and I'd like to clarify, when I said more important, I mean in a broad sense, that beyond the Sacramento City Unified School District, there are concerns that stretch across the state because, as you said, the funding structure and the funding impact is hitting districts everywhere. State Superintendent Tony Thurman had called at Sac City Unified for all parties to get back to the bargaining table. So let's listen to District Representative Alex Barrios.
We welcome the state superintendent's efforts to get the parties together to discuss and arrive at a common understanding of the district's budget. This will hopefully help move the district forward on efforts to commence negotiations with SCTA. We welcome the state superintendent and others that are calling for SCTA leaders to come to the bargaining table. We've been inviting SCTA leaders to commence contract negotiations since November 2018.
One of the reasons he's pointing that out is that it's a little bit unusual that the state superintendent would jump in and say, I want to get everybody back together again. But in this case, contract negotiations have pulled the mayor in at different times. We had the county superintendent, Dave Gordon. We had a representative from the Department of Education talk with us. And it's been an ongoing effort to deal with a really severe budget crisis. I do want to let everybody know that the district is holding public workshops to talk about the budget, and two more are planned. There's one this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Luther Burbank High School, another one on Thursday, May 30th at Einstein Middle School at 6 o'clock, and we have that information on our website. So CTA has been a very active participant, obviously, in many districts, but in particular Sac City.
Yeah, for sure. And you're definitely right that it's an all hands on deck situation. You know, it's not just the local players, but the state superintendent is getting involved. And as you mentioned, the mayor as well. What it comes down to is no one on any side of this wants to see a state takeover of a school district. I don't think anyone would say that, yeah, that would be the ideal situation. While it is unusual, it's not totally surprising that the state superintendent is looking to bring people together and say, hey, look, what can we do to ensure that we avoid this takeover and find some common ground?
So there are going to be a variety of approaches, and we're going to hear the CTA president here comment about finding a solution.
It's not going to be one fix that's going to be the silver bullet for public education or making the tax system more equitable, but it's going to take a series of things that are going to bring in enough revenue to the state so that we can do that.
I'm talking with Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd, and that was the president of the California Teachers Association, Eric Hines. Let's talk more then about specific legislation and what he's referring to in specific solutions.
Sure. So that was from a conversation that I had with him yesterday. And what he was speaking to is that they were happy to see increased funding in the governor's May revised budget. The governor had increased funding levels to what he called historic for K through 12. Now, whether or not that is accurate, that may be a question for our colleague Chris Nichols with PolitiFact. But nevertheless, he did tout that it's a lot of money going to K through 12 education. And the president of CTA lauded him for that. However, he said this one-time funding or the one-time funding in the budget, that's great for this coming year. But he foresees issues coming up down the line. And the legislation that's being introduced, as he said in the clip, there's nothing that's a silver bullet. There's no one thing that will solve the problem. It's a number of smaller things. For example, one bill would reestablish redevelopment districts, which could allow for greater local tax collection that could go to education. There's also the issue of charter schools. There's a bill package that would put a cap on charter schools in California and would grant local school districts more authority over approval of charter schools. This would give local districts potentially more funding, but certainly more control over and more, I guess you could say, oversight over their district in terms of figuring out what schools are going to be there, what funding is going to look like. So there are a number of approaches, a number of pieces of legislation to address this issue of funding.
Nothing that works to repeal Prop 13, but I think in just what you said, there are bites at it or efforts to try to change the impact of it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing that says we need to repeal this proposition. That would be a monumental task. That's something that's been on the books for decades. But they're seeing smaller ways, as you said, to take bites from it or figure out ways to claw back some of that local tax funding that Proposition 13 drew away from local districts.
What's the education world's attitude toward the rainy day fund and the size of the rainy day fund?
That was, from what I could see, the main criticism that Governor Newsom faced for his budget. The president of the California Teachers Association, for the most part, said, hey, this is great. We love to see the increased funding. We love to see the loan repayments for teachers coming into California. But we think that the rainy day fund is growing too big. We think that we need this funding right now. If there's a rainy day, it's today. At the very least, it's an overcast sky out there. So they would like to see more of that funding hit schools sooner rather than later. That was one of their main criticisms of the revised budget.
So I set up this conversation talking about the funding structure, that the whole flow of money into schools is what the teachers are looking at, not so much just the isolated contracts, even though that's where the smaller battles happen. What in the overall sense would be so monumental, so shifting that California could really move from the 41st state in per pupil funding? Other than a Prop 13 change, really?
You know, I think different people would say different things. I think the Teachers Association would say one thing, which is a lot of what I elaborated on here, changes to those taxing structures. I think some people would say, on the flip side, on the charter school side, that school choice is an important way to address that, that people who are living in districts where the school system, the public school system and traditional schools are failing or are struggling, that those parents and those students should have an opportunity to choose charter schools. So, you know, not only is there not one silver bullet, but there isn't necessarily one answer to these questions from any side of the debate. I think if I knew the answer to that question, people would definitely be eager to know about it.
It is rhetorical, and maybe there is no answer. But before we go, let's do go to some of the numbers. We were talking about the budget changes as it stands in the governor's May revise. What do the budget numbers look like?
So in his revised budget, there's a general fund of $147 billion, and $81 billion of that goes to K through 12 education and community colleges. And that's up $3 billion from last year. Again, Newsom called it the highest investment in K through 12 education in the state's history. And, you know, it goes to a variety of things. About $600 million of it would go to building or renovating kindergartens across the state over the next 3 years. There's also some money in there for childcare. One thing that Newsom made sure to highlight in his press conference for the revised budget was this $90 million going to college loan assistance to fill teacher vacancies across the state. So there's a teacher shortage, and that's feeding into issues like large classroom sizes and students not getting the attention that they need in classrooms. So that was something that he made sure to hit on. And then at the college level, he also wanted to set aside $10 million to help college students with emergency housing costs.
I know you've done more work on the charter school arena than what we just talked about. So we have a moment for you to say more about what charter schools are looking at in terms of their power in the education picture in California.
Sure. So the charter school laws have been on the books now in California for in their current state for several decades, and they've largely remained unchanged. There are about 1,300 charter schools in California, and right now, for the most part, charter schools are content with how things are going, but they see that the legislation being proposed and backed by the California Teachers Association could change things quite a bit. And speaking to the president of the Teachers Association yesterday, he made it clear that he sees Governor Gavin Newsom's time in office as a big opportunity for them. Governor Brown, while he did take several steps, such as limiting or rather curbing for-profit charter schools, he declined to sign or approve other pieces of legislation. Newsom talked about it on the campaign trail. Within a couple months of him stepping into office, he signed a bill to increase transparency for charter schools. It was a piece of legislation that Governor Brown had vetoed several times. So they're seeing Newsom as a friendly face in the governor's office, and some of the pieces of legislation would, as I mentioned before, cap the number of charter schools in California, grant more authority to local school districts to approve which charter schools will operate there, and again, just increase oversight and regulation of them.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you. Again, we should let everybody know that downtown Sacramento is going to be quite busy today from the march that begins at
1:30
at the Capitol, and we'll go into downtown and then continuing on with the rally that I guess is the highlight celebration at 5 o'clock today. And then maybe a concert afterwards.
And possibly some live music. Yeah. So if you're down there, expect some traffic jams.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio's state government reporter. You can find more information, including details about those budget workshops that are happening in the Sac City Unified School District at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio.
Don't look surprised, I'm staying a while. Until the lights dim low and the stars are in the glow. Well, no fooling, I wanna get used to you. Second to no one, I'm proud of the sun. It gets jealous of your luminous smile.
Big way!
Ali, fabulous, he, Ali above.
This is Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, and Prince Ali is Aladdin. If you have young children in your life, you could probably sing along with that soundtrack from Disney's Aladdin. Aladdin, Princess Jasmine, and of course the Genie are on stage in Sacramento this week as the Broadway touring show of this award-winning musical continues through June 2nd. So we kind of threw it out there and made a wish that the Genie would pop into our studio for a visit. Here he is. Major
Boom,
Attaway.
Poof, here I am. How you
Welcome.
Doing? Thank you. Thank
Glad
you for having me.
You
Hello,
here.
Everybody.
The original?
Actually, no, I'm not. James is the original. I'm the first person to step in on Broadway after him.
Okay.
Yes,
well,
ma'am.
I just gave you a very big credit then.
I will accept the love.
Jacob Dickey has the title role of Aladdin through most of the Sacramento run, although mm-hmm. there's a little trade-off in the roles. Jacob, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate that you're here early in the morning because these are big nights and the enthusiasm here has been really wonderful for the show, hasn't it, Major?
Yes, it's been well received. The audiences have been electric. It's been great.
I want to know why it is that we love to make wishes, and I think you should be an expert on that by now.
Oh, of Ooh. Course. You know, that's a great question. It's a universal thing. I think that's the biggest thing that brings people together around the energy of the genie is the idea that it doesn't matter who you are, everyone can have an answer for what would your three wishes be. Mm. Yeah, I think that's exactly it about. Why? That's the quickest way to bring everyone around the genie, because you can ask anyone, and what would be one for you?
A wish for me mm-hmm. would be right now. Health has been important in our little Insight group. We have a team member who's had a little bit of challenge this week, Mark Jones. So, Mark, I'm giving you one of my genie wishes, that you have continued good health.
That's beautiful.
And I think that it kind of depends what's on the top of your mind. Do you think your wishes change? Genie, do you think about your own wishes?
That's exactly what I was going to say. My wishes change with the season, with the day, with my meal. It depends. I may wish to have that again, or you know, I totally agree. So yeah, that's what I was getting to, is that it all depends. But that's the best part about it. It's always there. Those wishes can always be, you know, be brought up, whether they're large or small, or you know, for one person or for many.
Jacob, this film and this show are the coming of age story for Aladdin. But in the Disney world, to have the boy's story really highlighted is unique, and I think sets it apart in some ways. So what about that transformation that you go through in the idea of wishing?
Well, I think at the core of the story, it's fairly universal. It's just a young boy who wants to make his mom proud. You know, I have a mom, surprise.
Most people do.
And like, she's the most incredible woman in the world. And so to be able to come on stage and share that story, which is my story and which is many people's story. Even if you're missing a mom in your life, you have a parent or you have a figure that you just want to make proud. And to be able to tell that story every night, is really magical. Yeah.
Where is your mom, by the way?
My mom is in Virginia. I'm originally from Virginia Beach. So she's across the country right now.
When has she seen you in this role, in this show?
Well, I actually was Aladdin in New York for about a month when I first started, and my mom came on Mother's Day for the first time to see me as Aladdin. So singing Proud of Your Boy on Mother's Day to my mom was pretty amazing.
For the audience, that place, that cave of wonders, when the two of you meet and the two of you navigate how you're going to be together, is so magical. In this show, it's really fantastic. Mm. And Genie, your entire head is glittered.
Yes. Yes, ma'am. That is. I think it's a beautiful tie-in to the shimmer and the gold of the entire moment. You know, the mystery of that cave of wonders, the danger, the excitement, the fact that it's filled with all of this treasure. But yes, the glitter is the best and worst part.
I was going to say
about being the genie.
Like, I'm jealous, but I'm not jealous.
That's what I wanted to know. You know, it's kind of easy for him. He really just has to put a vest on over his bare skin.
Truly, look,
don't get me started.
there's a lot spoken about his physique, and I was watching you dance and turn and thinking that glitter is seamless.
I appreciate that.
Hey, talk about the friendship between the two of you, and you have to have some chemistry. I don't think you can do a scene like that. Although Major, maybe anybody would have chemistry with you because you're fun, and what seems to be improv just kind of flows so naturally. First of all, does the show change every night a little bit for you?
Yes, without question. But that's an energy flow for the genie itself. You know, we have to. There's a certain amount of energy that comes with the idea of being in the lamp for 10,000 years and coming out, and the first person, you know, well, this person gets to see what you're capable of. You know, that energy permeates every single performance. But it does change depending on, you know, a lot of different things, depending on audience reaction to certain jokes and to the rhythm of certain jokes, or to just how, you know, how I physically or mentally got myself back to that genie energy. That affects our friendship in the show, which it's, you were asked that question as well. It's a bromance, really.
Yeah, it is.
you made me think of it when you said it's a male-heavy show as well, and the uniqueness of that, I think, adds to our energy. And it's, I'm happy to be his cheerleader and on stage and off, really, but the lessons that we learn, it's beautiful how the lessons that we have to learn kind of mirror each other, you know, in the show. I'm trapped, he's not, and we both want the opposite and don't realize that we kind of already have it and that type of thing. So
yeah.
It's you know, on the surface it can be the flash and the fun, but honestly for us it gets meaty, if you will, when it comes to how we put together our friendship in the short scenes that we have in between the songs.
That's Major Attaway. He is the genie in the touring Broadway musical Aladdin, which continues in Sacramento through June 2nd. I want to hear more about that same topic from you, Jacob.
Sure.
Jacob Dickey is in the role of Aladdin. So what about the bromance, the celebration of the two of you together, and how you have to look at him like he just appeared out of nowhere and you're so startled and you have to recreate that really big reaction every show?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it helps that Major is actually very cool in real life and he's easy to get along with. Most of the genies are, actually all the genies are, that I have worked
There's
with.
More than one?
There are more than one. Not here.
He's pretty convincing that he's very the only convinced. One.
Or are there? Or I have a theory that we're all the same genie, but
well,
please
okay,
continue.
Well, see.
Well, you were
one.
The one that
multiple
had
dimensions.
A little Sacramento memento with you. I'm not going to give anything away,
oh, sure,
but there
yeah.
was a little Sacramento touch to your genie arrival.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny, speaking about my reaction to genie appearing, being genuine, a few nights ago, there was a technical difficulty, and Major wasn't able to come out of what he comes out of. I did not know that, and I was on stage, and he leapt out of the wings doing this big belly roar, which he does, and I truly shrieked. I was actually fully shaken up. So sometimes it is a genuine reaction.
Were you in any kind of a panic thinking, what am I going to do? Or is that just part of the improv of?
Oh, yeah. No panic necessary.
Yeah.
For my character, the genie himself, you're right. That I just let it be a part of the improv.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That happens often. And then I think when you can find a balance between that energy, the audience will join you. You know, because if a mistake happens and it's blatant enough that it doesn't just flow seamlessly into whatever else is going on, then, I mean, I'm the genie. You know, it's my magic that I'm creating.
Right.
Maybe I'm a little rusty. It's been 10,000 years.
Right.
Come on.
You laugh about it. The audience laughs about it.
It's all right.
Rusty or not, never had a friend like me,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Oh, let's cue the music on that. Here we go.
bop, wop, wop, skibbity-doo, bop-a-dum-a-wop, wop, wop, skibbity-wop, wop, wani-a-da-da. Can you give me a body-a-da-da?
Body-a-da-da.
Good scotty-wop.
Scotty-wop.
Everybody, bibbity-bobbity-boo.
Bibbity-bobbity-boo.
Wop-a-wop-a-wop-a-wop. I thought I had a thousand tails. We master you in luck, cause up your sleep, you got a brand of magic never fail. You got some power in your corner now, some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz, yahoo and how. See, all you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say,
Mr. Aladdin, sir,
what
will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, shout it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. Now, now, now.
Our, my coworkers are coming past the window, peeking in. They want to see the genie in Aladdin. I love the line, get your wish on now. Get your wish on. This is a pretty fantastic show.
Yeah.
The costumes, the pyrotechnics, the flying carpet, and Jacob, tell me, that carpet really is flying, right?
It is actually flying, yes.
Your feet are not hooked into like snowboard straps or anything?
No, no. Not at all.
That's right. The magic is real, man.
The magic. No, that carpet is truly magical. The first time I saw it in real life, I actually cried just because.
Oh, yeah, it's breathtaking.
It's breathtaking. I grew up, and you grow up with that image of
right.
seeing a carpet, and you, it's an animation, and then you see it in real life, and it is incredibly well done on stage.
So this film was based on 1001 Nights, and I remember the film being released between my two little kiddos in 1992. Mm-hmm. What's your memory of first seeing Aladdin, Jacob, as a film or a story?
Aladdin was absolutely one of my favorite Disney movies growing up. I mean, I was born in 1991, so it was kind of right around. I was a 90s Disney kid.
Yeah.
I wanted to be Aladdin. There are pictures of me. My mom made an Aladdin costume for Halloween one year. But yeah, I mean, he was kind of the first prince and first Disney that character that looked like me. You know, I'm mixed race. And growing up, seeing a lot of white princes was great, and I could, you know, identify with them. But seeing Aladdin was like, oh, cool, I could be that person, and ended up being that person.
Where did you study theater?
James Madison University. It's a college in Virginia.
Major Attaway, I have to tell everybody that you played Frosty in Frosty the Snowman,
yes,
too.
Yes, ma'am.
And I think in every character where there needs to be improv, there needs to be personality, and I'm going to add that magic ingredient of love, because there's so much love in those characters. Are you picky about what you choose to do?
I mean, I think as an actor, that is possibly a loaded question.
I think so, too. That's why I asked you.
Yeah.
Because well, on one hand, you want to work.
Yep.
Correct.
On the other, you need to be who you think you are and
right.
want to be.
Yeah. Let me say that my answer is I enjoy the fantasy work, even when, because it's still based in the, you know, the rawest human emotions. And I think sometimes it's that escapism can bring people together in an easy way. And so I think when the curtain opens and it's ready for me, you know, it's time for me to be the genie. Sometimes it's almost like you just know that we've all come together to buy into this moment to sit here and let me tell you this story. So I think, yes, I will say I'm partial to it. I won't say that I don't love a good ragtime moment either. How's that?
Yeah.
How about the reboot of the film coming out this Friday, I think? Will Smith?
Super excited.
So excited.
Have you had any previews, any sneak peeks?
Well, we haven't. I think we as a group are going to see the show, yes.
We are.
But we haven't done that yet. But I think a few of our Disney cousins in New York have gotten to see it ahead of time, so we're a little jealous, and they won't tell us, and we don't want them to. But yes, we're very excited to see the adaptation of the film.
So Clinton Greenspan is the other Aladdin that's in this cast. Is there another genie? Do you have an understudy?
Well, the genie has standby rooms. We have standbys.
Okay. Yes.
Now, and they are as important as my presence in the production. I truly believe that, because every genie has to be able to do exactly what one does. Mm-hmm. So, and more.
Mm-hmm. Anybody, does the standby tour with the company?
Yes,
or?
Ma'am. Yes, okay. Ma'am. Standbys are in the building for every performance, no matter what.
Okay.
Because if anything happens,
right.
someone has to be able to put that glitter on their head and go out there and finish the
stage.
Number.
Yeah.
Right. So, that's how crucial they are to the survival of the performance, you know, of the
yeah.
work itself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They cover not only the genie, but either of them covers an additional role as well. So they're the glue that holds us together.
Well, I was graced by a flying streamer in the middle of the show.
You took home a souvenir.
I did. 38 tons of flying scenery in the show, 84 illusions and effects. There was a time when suddenly a whole meal appeared on a coffee table that I had to double check. I still, to this moment, don't know how that happened.
That's one of my favorites.
A lot of the magic, and so many people backstage to help make the costume changes happen, the dancing. It's really a great show. So a final quick thought from each of you about how the character you play has rolled into who you are. Jacob, how's a little of Aladdin in with you every day?
I think his confidence has gone with me into real life. You know, he struggles, but through the entire show, he knows what he wants, even if he doesn't know who he is. And he has a confidence in that grows throughout the show. And I think by the end of the show, he is aware of what he truly wants and needs and what will make him a better person. And I think that confidence leaks over into my life.
You're so likable and charming and talented.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
And Major Attaway, for the genie, how is the genie with you every day?
His reasoning. Mm. The genie has a forced confidence. I like that you said that, Jacob. But for me, it's his reasoning. When there's a couple of lines where he says to Aladdin, just be yourself.
Mm.
You know, that can be a lot or a little bit. And at the end of the show, when Aladdin says something to the effect of, I have to, you say it to Jasmine, I have to stop being someone I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, though the reasoning behind that is what has really come with me. You know, all that power, all that magic, but here's what really matters.
Okay, let's snap our fingers on three. The show is going to be done. That's Insight for today. And Aladdin continues. This is Insight 1, 2, 3.